Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, this February 24th, 2008, we have a terrific guest for you, someone we've been working to get for a while. We're going to have one of the pioneers of internet journalism and one of the leading voices in the African-American journalistic community. Our guest will be Glenn Ford, the publisher and editor of the website America's Black Forum, now the Black Agenda Report. He'll be joining us live today, but first, before we go to Glenn Ford, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Late-night talk show hosts are no longer writing their own scripts, and America's television viewers will once again see new episodes of their favorite shows. TV and film writers headed back to work last week after a three-month walkout. The Writers Guild of America went on strike against the Hollywood studios to ensure they would be paid for their work when it's shown on the internet and other devices. Back in her office this week, Kate Purdy, a writer on the drama Cold Case, says she has no regrets about losing 3 months of paychecks.
We were pushed into a corner. We had no other option but to strike. I mean, no one wants to be out of work, but they just weren't going to give us any kind of jurisdiction in the internet or new media. I think eventually the financial reward will be there, but I do feel like there's sort of an emotional and a moral reward, too, that I think was important and that I do appreciate.
The writers want a piece of digital revenues, something that the studios did not want to give up.
I think there are a few different ways to measure the success of the strike, and one way is the contract, and it's satisfactory. It's a good, solid contract. There are places where everyone wishes the terms could be better. But I think more than that, where we really succeeded was in terms of sort of galvanizing and unifying our membership. People are more aware of what their union does for them. They're more responsible to each other. And I think that has been incredibly enlightening for the membership, and that's been a great success.
Unions in recent decades have not generally fared well in negotiations against big industries. It was good to see a union stick to their guns and win, Purdy says.
I think the whole nation is ready for change and for moving forward and for less corporate greed and more sharing with its workers. So I hope moving forward that is more and more the case. I hope maybe we set a precedent or started something.
And now here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact.
Japan has the fastest broadband speeds and the lowest cost per megabit per second of all countries surveyed, according to a recent report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Japan enjoys cost per megabit over four times lower than that of the United States.
There are vast portions of the public airwaves in between the broadcast channels on your TV dial. Most of this valuable spectrum, 40 to 80% in major metropolitan areas, remains empty. These unused frequencies are called white spaces, and several public interest groups are pressuring the Federal Communications Commission to set them free. Sasha Meinrath, research director of the Wireless Future Program at the New America Foundation, says that this spectrum could be used for internet access and a variety of new devices that would allow anything from local micro-broadcasting to audio and video streaming and voice-over internet phones. But there are those who want to keep the white spaces closed.
The main opponents of opening up the public airwaves to the general public are the National Association of Broadcasters and several manufacturers of wireless microphones. And the reason why they're against this is because they want to be able to utilize and sort of capture all of this spectrum for their own uses.
If the FCC were to open the spectrum up to unlicensed devices, however, it could dramatically lower the cost of broadband services while increasing their capabilities. That makes broadcasters nervous.
It creates this two-way flow of information that is antithetical to this notion of, I control the airwaves, you get what I decide to give you.
White space devices are a sign that the end may be near for the broadcast era, says Meinrath.
The broadcast era has served us very well for a very long time. but it's based on notions of technologies and capacities that are 70 years old and don't take into account things like computer technology and cognitive radios and smarter digital communications. White space devices are really saying, you know, we can do far better and make far more efficient use of our public airwaves. But it does mean that we have to rethink these business models and these broadcast models that are incredibly antiquated given today's technology.
For more information about white spaces, go to spectrumpolicy.org or www.freepress.net/spectrum.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is Glenn Ford, who, along with Peter Gamble, created America's Black Forum, the first nationally syndicated black news interview program on commercial television back in 1977. So he is a veteran of broadcast journalism and journalism. Glenn Ford then went on to be the co-publisher, lead editor, and founder of the internet magazine Black Commentator. And then in 2006, Glenn Ford left there to start Black Agenda Report. Glenn Ford is based in Jersey City, New Jersey. He's joining us on the phone today. Glenn Ford, welcome to Media Matters.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you. I consider Black Agenda Report to be must reading for people who want to stay on top of politics in the United States. And I hope our listeners, if they're not familiar with it, will go to blackagendareport.com and make it a regular stop along the way. Why don't you talk, first of all, about Black Agenda Report? Why did you start it? What's its purpose? Who writes for it? What's the idea behind it? And how do you support it?
Well, in fact, the entire editorial staff of Black Commentator joined me in leaving Black Commentator and starting Black Agenda Report. We wanted to have the ability to do a more journalistic journal, to tell you the truth. That is, a journal that whose stories and whose way of looking at the world is the product of the staffers discussing where should we be going, what should we be looking at, how should we be positioning ourselves in order to be of most use to the black and progressive community. That's our purpose. So we do commentary and analysis, but it's all based in basic journalism.
And how many people are there who contribute on a regular basis to Black Agenda Report, Glenn?
Excuse me, I didn't understand.
How many contributors do you have, regular contributors?
Oh, geez, we never counted them up. You're talking about people who contribute stories, correct?
Correct, yes.
We've been developing them since Black Commentator days. Mm-hmm. I never did take the time to see how many we had. We just see the quality of the contribution that they make. But our staff, the core staff is Bruce Dixon. He's the managing editor. And Margaret Kimberly. She's our senior columnist. We also have brotherly, sisterly ties with CBC Monitor. That's the Congressional Black Caucus Monitor. Mm-hmm. That was the first organization set up by black people to measure the performance of black congresspersons based on the historical black political consensus. And the CBC Monitor puts out twice yearly report cards on the black members of Congress, and has also extended those report cards to those congresspeople whose districts include 25% or more black constituents.
One of the things that's really striking, Glenn Ford, as I read Black Agenda Report and Black Commentator for that matter too, but especially Black Agenda Report on the web, is that your website, your publication, does not pull any punches when it comes to assessing politicians, whatever their race or their background. I mean, you really are as critical, I think, of African-American politicians as any website I've seen on the internet.
I suppose we are more critical because they are more relevant to our core constituency, which is 70% African-American. The other 30% of our readership is non-African-American. But these are the folks who must be held to account for their constituents' basic political beliefs, which are progressive. Black America is a progressive demographic. And in fact, using the terms liberal and moderate and conservative as they are used with white America make no sense whatsoever in Black America. And lots of studies have been done, but we've done our own. And we find that white people who call themselves liberal are actually more conservative than Black people who designate themselves as being conservative. Mm-hmm. There is no match here because there is no match in the experience. So as we evaluate folk, because it is a very different community, and because we are evaluating in terms of the CBC monitor, people who are elected by that community, of course we have a different standard for them. That's not unfair. That is eminently fair.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Glenn Ford, who you're listening to. He's the executive editor of Black Agenda Report. And Glenn Ford, the big story, obviously, in politics this year is the presidential election and the historic, and there's really no other word to put it, the historic race in the Democratic primary between the two finalists being a woman and an African-American gentleman running for the nomination of the Democratic Party. What is your assessment of the Barack Obama phenomenon?
Well, there is no question that it is a phenomenon, one like we have never seen, one like no one has ever seen, because there's never been an age like this. I suppose you mean by assessment, whose side are we on? And we're not on either one side. And there's a very simple explanation. Politically, programmatically, proposal-wise, they are twins. Hillary and Barack are political twins. And that's one of the reasons that as people evaluate these debates on corporate media, even corporate media has finally come to the conclusion that there isn't a dime's worth of difference between these people in terms of what they would do in foreign policy and what they would do domestically. They are the same. So the question then becomes for a publication that is run by Black people and whose core audience is Black people, are we supposed to support the Black twin over the white twin? And are all things equal here? Our position here is, and it's not a very popular one, that with these two conservative Democrats, and that's what they are, Hillary Clinton is DLC, of course, Democratic Leadership Council, the corporate wing, the bag man, the corporate money bag of the Democratic Party. And I think we'll have time to explain why Barack Obama is, in fact, part of that same wing. If that is true, and it is, and Black people by now almost universally support Barack Obama, what kind of distortions, contortions, problems politically does that present to a Black America that is infatuated with a candidate who, in fact, doesn't support what Black people as a whole support, that is the Black political consensus? This is the major problem that we face, and this is why, no, we're not backing Barack Obama as a candidate. Of course, we're not backing Hillary either.
Our guest today, Glenn Ford, the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, can be found online at blackagendareport.com. This is a live show we're doing here of Media Matters at WILL AM 580. Our telephone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Phone lines are open. Feel free to call in, if you will. Let's go back and elaborate, if we can, Glenn Ford, a little bit on your point that there is a great deal in common and very little to distinguish the records or the positions of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. One of the issues that Barack Obama raises in his campaign to distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton is that he opposed the invasion of Iraq from the beginning, where she supported it. How do you regard that as a difference between the two of them?
I'm so glad that we have the opportunity on your show to talk for almost an hour, because I really want to bring that back to the this discussion back to the summer of 2003, when Bruce Dixon and I were at Black Commentator, and Barack Obama was running in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate nomination. At that point in the summer of 2003, he was ranked generally around number four in the field, and so he was hungry for any kind of support he could get. And Bruce Dixon and I noticed two things. One, Barack Obama had taken from his campaign website that 2002 speech that he made, what's now touted as the Great Speech, so historically significant, was not seen by Barack Obama and his camp in 2003 after the invasion was a fact, and after George Bush had declared mission accomplished, and while mass public opinion, not black public opinion, but mass public opinion, was in favor of the war. He had taken that speech off of his website. And everybody who knows anything about politics knows there's meaning there. The other thing was we had been doing our usual patrols to see what black politicians may have joined the corporate wing of the party in the form of the Democratic Leadership Council, and there is Barack Obama's name right there on the list, and also a cameo presentation that the DLC gives to all of its vetted, cleared, favorite politicians, 100 to look out for. And so it was very clear to us that Barack Obama was renouncing, or rather burying, his anti-war position now that it was out of sync with mass popular opinion, and had actually joined, allowed his name to be put on the list of the Democratic Leadership Council. So we confronted him. And because he was ranked number four, not given good chances, looking for support wherever he could get it, he allowed us to engage him in a month-long back-and-forth dialogue, much of which made it into print and can be seen in Black Commentator and on Black Agenda Report pages, in which we challenged him as to whether he was a DLC member. He said he was not aware that he had been placed on the membership list. Clearly, that's incredible. And why he had taken off that speech. He also incredibly claimed, well, you know, you change your website, things become old. By that time, his opposition in 2002 to the war had become old. Mm-hmm. And so this is how we developed our own opinions of what kind of politician Barack Obama was and could promise to be. At the end of that month-long dialogue with Bruce Dixon and I, Barack Obama put that speech back on his website, and he publicly asked and got the DLC to take his name off of their list. However, his political behavior did not change. Now, I want to say that in order to make it very clear that we didn't try to badmouth Obama. We wanted him to explain himself. And to further that story, we gave him a three-question bright lines test. If he answered the questions correctly, as far as we were concerned, then he shouldn't be in the DLC. If he answered them incorrectly, well, then he might as well be a member of the DLC. And they included, would he withdraw from NAFTA? Would he support single-payer health care? And the question on Vietnam that was, Iraq, I'm showing my age here, on Iraq, that would verify whether what he said in his speech he actually believed. Well, he actually did not pass any of the that test. He didn't answer correctly any of these three questions. But we saw that Barack Obama was such an attractive package that if he got traction, that in the end of that process, he would have overwhelming support in the black community. And we did not want to, at that stage in the game, appear to be trying to hold a young up-and-coming brother back. So we were aware, even back in 2003, of what might happen in terms of us as journalists trying to make a change if we found ourselves on the other side of the juggernaut, the avalanche, the Obamamania that might be coming.
It now looks, Glenn Ford, like I think Barack Obama has a very good chance of winning the Democratic nomination. In fact, it'd be quite surprising if he did not win it at this point. And a reasonable chance of winning the election in November. Is this a surprise to you, notwithstanding his political views, or even withstanding his political views? The reason I ask this is I recall a conversation not too long ago with Jesse Jackson Sr. when he was talking about his son, saying, why don't people think he could be a candidate for governor or senator? This is less than a decade ago. Like, that was just such, at that time, the idea that an African-American politician could receive a majority of white votes was still considered almost impossible to conceive of. And here we are talking about Barack Obama being elected president of the United States. I mean, are you surprised by this, or is this something you anticipated?
There are two questions in there. I know you didn't mean to, but
well, go ahead. Yeah, help me.
We need to.
Okay.
We are not surprised. In fact, anticipated, as I was saying, that he would get overwhelming black support. That was a given. This is a talented man. This guy has skills, and we knew that even if he still clinged to his right-wing Democratic policies. And this is the right wing of the party that he's associated with. Make no question about, have no doubts about that, that black support was secure. In terms of white support, what do you have to judge by that? How do you make an informed guess? Well, we didn't have to make an informed guess just based upon some generalities. The reason that Barack Obama is in contention so strongly for the presidency, and he will win this primary, is because he has dedicated targeted all of his messages to white males. When people talk about the demographics in this primary season, they pay far too much attention to whether Hispanics are voting along with blacks, and not enough attention to the guerrilla demographic, the 600-pound guerrilla historical anomaly that we have seen, and that is that Barack Obama gets majorities of white males. Now, white males, and this is not said with some kind of vindictive tone, they're just based upon the numbers historically. White males are the most conservative demo in the country. The most, in descending order, the progressive demographic goes like this. Most progressive black females. Second, black males. Third, Hispanic females. Fourth, Hispanic males. Fifth, white females. Sixth, at the bottom, white males. Why are white males supporting Barack Obama? There is no mystery about that. He is sending them code-worded messages very deliberately and with regularity that tell them he's all right. They're all right with him. He should be all right with them, that he agrees with them, or at least can understand them and sympathize with them, and he is no threat. And in that kind of sense, his campaign, and it's very weird and eerie, it's a black campaign that focuses, using code words, on white men. That's kind of crazy. You usually expect that to come from a Ronald Reagan.
What sort of code words, Glenn Ford? Give us an example, if you can, of how this coding works.
Oh, sure. In Selma, Alabama, the celebration of the Selma demonstrations in the spring of last year. Now, this is a big black event. That is, it's a national event that all of the candidates, regardless of race, had to go to. But it's focusing on an important piece of black history. So it's one of the black events in the large schedule. And he took that opportunity in Selma, Alabama, to say that blacks had already come 90% of the way to equality. Now, that's a ridiculous statement. It's a statement that has no basis in any of the social indexes, none whatsoever. If we talk about wealth, in fact, I'm not even going to go through all of them, but if we talk about wealth, black people's household wealth is 10% of the median white household's wealth. And we could talk about unemployment, and we talk about the imprisonment. There just is no index in which one could credibly say that blacks have gone 90% of the way to equality. And in fact, if any white politician, a white Democrat, had said that, that white Democrat would be pilloried and by black Democrats everywhere, by black people en masse, and would never live down that kind of statement. They would be racist to the core, to the end, in the black view. But Obama got away with it because he's black, and black people don't want to attack him. But white men heard that, and the signal to them was, oh, well, good. Here is Barack Obama telling us that all this talk about race, which I find so uncomfortable, well, this is almost over, that we won't have to be listening to these nuisance black militant types bringing up race at every juncture, making us so uncomfortable. And in fact, if we vote for Barack Obama, and blacks are already 90% of the way, maybe we can assume that that's the other 10%. And the discussion of race as a significant part of political discourse, will be over. That's a code word. He's done many others. His evaluation of Katrina is that the incompetence that followed the storm was colorblind. Well, the lesson of Katrina is, in fact, exactly the opposite. Katrina was not a storm. It was the federal racist and local governmental racist reaction to the aftermath of Katrina. But he dismisses that as a non-race thing. And more recently, he went before the editors of a conservative white newspaper in Nevada, and spoke words that anyone who read the transcript or saw it on YouTube would understand was conveying his belief, or what he said was his belief, that it was understandable that Reagan would become president and capture the voters' imagination in 1980 because of, and he didn't qualify this, because of the excesses of the 60s and the 70s. Those are code words, and anyone who understands the American electorate understands that those were code words targeted at white men who think of the 60s and early 70s as the big dividing line from when they were on top and praised for being so to when their supremacy, or rather their dominance of so many fields and politics and power, came into question. And he's done this in many, many different ways, on a basic level. And he has said this to me, to my face, one-on-one, that he will pursue policies that are race neutral. And race neutrality, although it could, race neutral policies, although they can trickle down to black folk, that is a trickle down, and it's not just the result of the policies, but the atmosphere that one must create in order to pass a race neutral policy that mitigates against discussion of race. So, do we want a black president who will have in his power to set the tone of discourse, who is determined that race not be part of that discourse?
Our guest today, who you're listening to here on Media Matters, is Glenn Ford, who is the head of the Black Agenda Report, editor, executive editor of it, which is found on the web at blackagendareport.com. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Black Agenda Report is a weekly but online publication which covers American politics primarily focusing on African-American politics and issues, but covering a broad range of issues there. And I urge our listeners to go there and check it out when you have an opportunity to do so. We've been talking about the Barack Obama campaign for the last for the first part of the show. And I'd like to switch gears slightly now, if we can, Glenn Ford, and talk now about a comment you made that it comes up periodically in articles on Black Agenda Report, which I find really interesting. And this is a quote, I think, from one of your articles, which is that the political business class of African Americans has been hopelessly corrupted. And really, I find your website's doing more watchdogging and muckraking on the African-American political business establishment than just about anywhere else on the web. Could you elaborate on that, what that means, what you're doing, what you're finding, what your argument is?
The argument revolves around our basic contention that we need a movement rather than election of individual blacks to high public office or high corporate office, and that the movement, then we have to go back in time and talk about, well, why don't we have a movement? We did have one, and although it's difficult to look in history and say when things ended that are broadly social, I suppose we could say it ended in 68 with the death of Dr. King. That is, in terms of its really mass character. Now, anyone who understands anything about Dr. King, beyond his the snippets of his I Have a Dream speech that now seem to be his signature, understands that Dr. King was well aware that, in fact, by 65, certainly by 66, the battle against Jim Crow, legal Jim Crow, had already been won. And he wrote voluminously about how the movement now had to shift into changes in social power relationships, economic power relationships, and that's where the movement needed to go. It was a hell of a turn. His turn to, against to a public stance, he'd always been against the Vietnam War, but to a dramatic public stance against the Vietnam War was, as he explained it, because he realized it was a war against the poor, and that the dollars and political capital that had been invested in a very embryonic war on poverty, which he saw as a move at least toward social democracy in the United States, that all of this was destroyed by the expenditures of political capital as well as real resources in the Vietnam War. So that's what prompted him to take that anti-war stance. It made him quite unpopular among lots of black folks. After King's death, and the anti-Jim Crow era of the civil rights movement having already been successful, we see this great splintering of the movement. There is no focus in terms of a personality. Malcolm, of course, had been dead for 3 years, and King was killed in April of 68. And the those who could use the newfound privileges of the end of Jim Crow struck out on their own. And they declared that the movement was not any longer about vast social transformation, which Dr. King sought, but about getting more black faces in high places, getting more mayors, more congresspeople, and more black millionaires. That kind of struggle is not necessarily the same thing, sometimes antithetical to real, ongoing, daily, mass black organization. Even a black mayor doesn't want a movement in his city. Movements, after he gains power, are as much of a nuisance to him as they are to a white mayor. Only movement that he wants is on election day so that he can retain power. But that is where we stopped. And it is from that stopping point that we see all of these accumulated problems of many decades without a movement, which finally lead us to this point in time, when a Barack Obama, who is no different from a Hillary Clinton, can galvanize almost universally black folks' imaginations, and much of it is imagination, because he's not talking about or going to do what they imagine he is talking about and doing, that there's a long history behind that. So we understand and emphasize the importance of creating a movement again. And we try to explain what a movement is and what it does. That's why you see that common theme in Black Agenda Report.
Our guest, Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Coming to you live today from Urbana, Illinois. Phone number here, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And part of the corruption, I guess, that I was getting to and that you report on in Black Agenda Report comes up with issues, for example, members of Congress who are in the Congressional Black Caucus who, because they're in districts that basically they win almost unanimous votes, there are no Republicans of any consequence in their district, find themselves in very cozy relationship with financial interests. For example, there were a number of African-American members of Congress who, if I'm not mistaken, voted for the bankruptcy bill that came before Congress last year.
10 of them, yes.
Yeah. And your website, I think, has been vigilant in sort of exposing this.
The CBC Monitor, our sister organization, and Black Agenda Report are the only ones who look at these people's actual voting records. And the voting records are the fruit of their new associations. Here's what happened. Excuse me. In the mid-90s, the corporate right realized that they hadn't been exercising their great weapon, which is money. In fact, that's the reason they rule, is because of money. There aren't that many of them in that ruling circle, but they have all the money. And that they had been going up a dead end, or two dead ends, in trying to have some influence in Black America. But what the corporate right had been doing is focusing on Black Republicans up to about the mid-90s. Well, there hasn't been a Black Congressperson from a majority Black district since 1935 in Chicago.
Republican, you mean?
A black Republican,
yeah.
Being elected from a Black district.
Mm-hmm.
There have been Black Republican congresspersons, but they all come from white districts.
Mm-hmm.
And not too many of them. So clearly that was a dead end. What the corporate right had done also is to support obscure Black academics like Thomas Sowell and Glenn Lowry, and book them on television shows and put them on tours and endow their chairs and things like that. But nobody listened to them. These were totally marginal characters, and that didn't work at all. But in the 1990s, the Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, which George Bush calls his favorite foundation, and he means it, said, no, why don't we fund Black organizations with conservative right-wing agendas, which we'll draw up, that are designed to actually get into Black Democratic politics. And you can't do that without going straight up into Democratic politics, not Republican politics. And it is from those efforts that there was created an impetus in corporate America to actively solicit, to find, and to fund these right-wing Black Democrats, like Cory Booker, who tried in 2002 to become mayor of Newark. He would have been the first right-wing Black mayor of a major city. And succeeded in toppling Earl Hilliard, congressman from Black Belt, Alabama, and Cynthia McKinney in the same year, with these conservative corporate funded Black politicians. So they were very successful in that strategy, and with the aid of the media wing of corporate America, corporate media, they have basically drawn up a list, an ever-changing list, but a list of those new Black politicians who have rejected the old, this in quotes, civil rights type agitation politics in favor of creating some kind of biracial coalitions. Barack Obama fits directly into that. So this is a rather new thing, basically only making its mark in the year 2002, but which has led to to a wide swing in the behavior of the Congressional Black Caucus, so that finally by 2005 we see significant numbers of the Congressional Black Caucus voting for the Republican energy bill, for the Republican bankruptcy bill, for black congresspersons voting for Bush's war powers in 2002. This is the point that the Congressional Black Caucus begins its descent into corruption, that is, Republican money corruption, until finally, in 2006, we have two-thirds of the Congressional Black Caucus voting for the telecom bill that would roll back decades of gains by blacks in cable and endanger internet neutrality. And that two-thirds share of the Congressional Black Caucus that this Republican corporate telecom bill received was a higher percentage than the Democrats in the Democratic caucus as a whole. So we see the Congressional Black Caucus going from the conscience of the Congress to being, in some instances, the most right-wing caucus in the Congress. This is a sea change, and it came about very, very quickly. And nobody's been keeping tabs on that except us and CBC Monitor.
Glenn Ford, our guest today. Glenn Ford is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. You can find that on the web at blackagendareport.com. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently with questions or comments for Glenn Ford. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Robert from San Francisco. You're on the air with Glenn Ford.
Hi. It's a pleasure to hear a voice of integrity on Media Matters like Mr. Ford's. He mentioned Cynthia McKinney, and this morning Ralph Nader announced that he's going to run for president again, and I think a lot of people are curious as to what's going to happen. I'm a white male, but I've been following McKinney's odyssey in politics, and I tell you, I've never met someone with such integrity and such a wonderful person, but I wonder if Mr. Ford would comment, what does he see as the future for the third parties, a separate movement? Does he see any possibility that Nader and McKinney might actually ally in some way or another? Or maybe he has some comments about Nader's appears to be independent run right now. I appreciate your answer.
Glenn, before you do answer, maybe for the sake of some of our listeners who might not be familiar with Cynthia McKinney or her recent history, maybe you could give a little background.
Well, Cynthia McKinney, I believe she went into Congress in 92 from DeKalb County, which is predominantly a black area right outside and including pieces of Atlanta, Georgia. McKinney amassed a remarkable record, not just of progressive voting, but of challenging at every juncture as a person, as a speaker, as a political being, the emerging strategy of Bush and company, what's commonly called the neoliberal status, neoconservative policies, in ways that no one else did. She was finally targeted in 2002, as I related, by a former Republican black, heavily funded by the same people that tried to elect Cory Booker in Newark, succeeded in electing Artur Davis, now the most conservative member, right-wing member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and she was defeated. She then returned a term later, recaptured her seat, but the following cycle was thrown out again.
In 2006?
Yes, in 2006. She's now decided that there is, apparently decided, that there is no future for black folks in the Democratic Party as constituted, and that what is needed is a new configuration. But it's really not clear, to get to what the caller was seemed to me to be inquiring about. It's not clear that the left bodies as presently constituted can do that. And I guess I'm speaking specifically of the Green Party, which has never been a very focused party, which has made big national news when Nader, who's not a member of the Green Party, by the way, never has been, has headed the ticket. In fact, the left is very, very disorganized, has not gone through the basic kind of work process to gather a critical mass of folk who are real activists around it, and any one of its grouplets. That's a job for us to start doing right now. McKinney is running for the nomination for the Green Party, but it's not clear that she's going to get it, to tell the truth. It's still possible that Nader will get it. He won their primary in California. I think that's their biggest state. So that is in flux. What we at Black Agenda Report believe is that we have to go back to basics. We have to draw up documents that say what we want and what we believe, and to attract folk to that kind of platform, rather than depend upon these older and not very successful political gatherings, but make something new. And we're not worried this election cycle about seeming to be spoilers or siphoning people's attention from the job of getting rid of the Republicans. Barack Obama, who will be the nominee, should beat McCain. And the only way I believe that he won't beat McCain is if they steal the election. And I don't know how one influences whether he steals the election or not, but I believe that real progressives, especially black progressives, ought to be laying the groundwork to put pressure on Barack Obama when he becomes president in an organized fashion. Because the great tragedy that is unfolding here is that black progressives have rolled up their tent, just totally disarmed themselves, and will not say a word to challenge Barack Obama, which means he can be expected during this general election phase to drift further to the right. It happens with every Democratic candidate. This man has a predilection to drift to the right, and that's what we can expect from him. And it's not going to be possible for these people who have endorsed him without complaint, without reservation, to act as challengers to his policies once he gets in. That's a job for real black progressives, and they need to be organized, and we need to be talking right now since we really can predict what he's going to do.
All right, Glenn Ford, well, let's get back to the phone lines. We have three callers waiting patiently. I want to get to all of them before the program ends.
Yes.
Glenn Ford, our guest again, who is the executive editor of Black Agenda Report. We've been talking about media, politics, and journalism. Let's go to line one now. Champagne, thank you very much for waiting so patiently. You're on the air with Glenn Ford.
Okay, I'll try to be very brief. Mr. Ford mentioned that 10, was it senators or representatives, voted for the bankruptcy bill, black representatives or senators. Would he clarify that?
I just representatives, because there's only one senator, that'd be Obama.
Okay. Well, he voted against it, of course, and Hillary and Biden voted for the bankruptcy bill. And a point I wanted to make, well, just of interest, is there's more and more ads for bankruptcy attorneys coming on late-night TV, which had disappeared for some time after that had passed, and they're back again. And, also, there was a debate. Dennis Kucinich wasn't involved in it. That was put on, I believe, by the AARP, if I have that correct. And Kucinich mentioned that all the Democratic candidates had to pledge not to bring up a single-payer system, and he wasn't. But I saw, let me get my thoughts together here, Barack in an interview or somewhere on C-SPAN in terms of Road to the White House mentioned that to a question that the single-payer system would be the best for this country, it's just not politically feasible. And that's my major comment. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank
yeah,
you.
In fact, but I'll just, before you take this away, Glenn, I'll just add, in one of the major debates, in fact, Obama began his comment on healthcare by saying, you know, if the rational system would be single payer, but we can't do that because we're stuck with these insurance and drug companies.
Yes, and Hillary basically says the same thing. And that's what makes them on that signal issue the same person. Just as they are really the same in terms of military expenditures as well.
Let's go to another line right now. We'll get another caller in. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report.
Hello.
Hello.
Speaking of stealing the election, back in 2000 in Florida, the Black Caucus basically had the grandmother of all poster people and the woman who voted for, I don't know, 30-some years and wasn't allowed to vote. But the whole issue of all the abominations in terms of Black voting kind of like just faded in away. I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
Yeah, that was a great shock to the Black body politic, that there was no challenge, that no white politician could be made to challenge. Not in 2000, and in 2004, only Senator Boxer from California would challenge. I want to remind people that although Barack Obama had just been elected to the Senate in 2004, he was already a full-fledged senator in 2004 when the issue came up, that is to raise a challenge to the certification of the election. So when Boxer stood up, Barack Obama could have stood up as well. I don't think most people have thought about that. Maybe they assumed that he, as a newbie, didn't have the right to stand with Boxer. He did. He had every right. He was a full-fledged legal senator and could have. He chose not to.
How seriously do you think the threat of stolen elections should be taken, Glenn Ford?
It should always be taken seriously, but what we have here is a really big split in the ruling class, which is why we have Barack Obama. Remember, he led Clinton early on, and all they talk a great deal about the small contributions. You don't even get the mechanism together to get those small contributions unless you have the critical mass of big corporate contributions. And Barack Obama, basically on the Democratic side, had a big lock on Wall Street. So that sector of the ruling class, they favor Barack Obama, and that made his candidacy actually viable, because you need hundreds of millions of dollars in order to be viable. He's now way ahead of Hillary Clinton, who was the darling of the corporate class, at least in terms of on the Democratic side. And so we really do have a full-blown split with a big, big section of corporate America having already decided that Barack Obama is all right with them, represents no threat. But we still have the institutional Republican Party, that is the people who have on the ground mechanisms for stealing an election, as they did in 2000 and 2004. So the threat comes from the institutional Republican Party, not from the larger corporate class that has for so long supported Republicans. In that sense, it's and that means that the corporate media, which is just an expression of corporate America, can be expected, I believe, at this time, to not turn such a blind eye to the institutional Republican Party's attempts to steal, and there will be attempts, there always are, to steal this election. And that also means that we're not so reticent about talking to progressives and saying, no, you shouldn't be so involved, drown in that ocean of enthusiasm, and neglect the fact that we need to make alternative political organisms this time around and as soon as possible.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest again, Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report. Let's go to line three, Champaign County. You're on the air with Glenn Ford.
Yeah, since there's only a moment left, I was going to ask you about, you keep referring to the corporate connections, and I was going to ask you to enunciate some of the most egregious. It seems to me my candidate for Obama's side, and of course Hillary's got a lot of things in that regard, but was going to bat for Exelon regarding tritium release right here on the ground in Braidwood nuclear plant and Dresden, just a horrible action, it seems to me, to defeat the right to know provisions. But I don't know if you want to go into that in the short moment left. I'm still recovering from Tony Williams interviewing Clarence Thomas this morning on PBS, and I'm always fed up with Juan Williams, who's written that awful book Enough, who is, you know, curiously enough, a commentator on their major theorist on NPR, but also on Fox. And your point of view is just so marginalized by this, even in what's called public media generally. I applaud you being on, and I'll listen. Thank you.
Yeah, NPR and public broadcasting are corporate media. They are in terms of funding, and they are in terms of practice. Barack Obama, Goldman Sachs, I believe, is his biggest supporter. That's why he doesn't want a moratorium on foreclosures and or a freeze on interest rates to at least ameliorate the effects on homeowners of this looming economic crisis. That's as far as you need to go there. Barack Obama also wants nuclear power to be in the mix. Although he downplays it, the people, it's there. It's in his literature and occasionally in his speeches when he's speaking to those types. But not too much attention is paid to that.
We've only got a minute left. Let's go to our final caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Glenn Ford.
Hi, thanks for a good program. I've long been an admirer of John Conyers, who waited patiently through the seniority system to become chair of judiciary. Why do you think that he and Nancy Pelosi didn't defend the Constitution and go for impeachment?
John Conyers is a hero of mine. He used to be a very, very, very good friend of mine. And so I'll take him at his word when he says that he has a lot more to do and that during the Republican domination of Congress, so many tasks went left undone. I believe that he probably does believe that, but I also believe that, in fact, he has given up fighting against that basically Democratic Leadership Council-dominated faction of the party that Pelosi, the Speaker, has joined. And he just doesn't have the energy or the will anymore to fight them.
You know, Glenn Ford, we've only got about a minute left. Maybe while we wrap up, you could let our listeners know what sort of websites and media do you go to stay on top of the world, in addition, of course, to your own website, Black Agenda Report?
Well, we have to go everywhere to see what people are talking about, and that includes the corporate media. The corporate media doesn't teach you much unless you really know how to read between the lines and find facts where they may be hidden. But you must know what the corporate media is saying, because that's what most people are saying. And it also shows you what the powers that be want you to hear. And that's quite important. But I'm not going to single out progressive sites because I'll leave some out, and that will make people angry. And you have a very popular show, and I don't want any of my favorite people angry at me.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Glenn Ford, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you with us.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.
And let's do this again. Let's reprise this moment down the road. I want to thank Andrew Boyle for being my producer, Brett Polson for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. We will be back in 167 hours, potentially with an Oscar winner. Our guest next week, Alex Gibney, nominated for Best Documentary Filmmaker. We'll find out his fate this evening. Until then, listeners, let's have a great week. See you then. Bye-bye.